Margaret Jones, and for a time I taught literature at the University of the West of England. I'm now retired, and I write biographies, feminist biographies of remarkable women.
Tell us about your literature teaching at UE. What were you teasing out? Because it's a big subject, English literature. Who were some of your favourite writers and why?
Well, Margaret Atwood is one, but I didn't actually teach her at UE. I taught literary theory, which I've largely left behind now, I suppose.
Is that like literary criticism?
I'm sorry?
Is that like literary criticism?
Yes, sort of. I mean, it covers a lot of things. It covers feminist theory and Marxist theory, historical approaches to literature.
You're obviously big on feminism. Why is that?
Well, because I'm a female and I don't like being discriminated against, I suppose. And I take an interest in women who've managed to buck that trend and to campaign for their own rights. And so I'm very interested in women in history who made a difference. I have a book on Alfred the Great's daughter, Æthelflæd, who founded towns in the Midlands. Lots of people don't know about that. Fought Vikings from the saddle. And then I wrote one about a Victorian Egyptologist called Amelia B. Edwards, who founded a society for training scholars and archaeologists, which still exists today. And my latest book, it's called She Spied for Freedom, is about a free black woman who posed, she was educated, and she posed as an illiterate slave in the house of the Confederate presidency in Richmond, Virginia. She spied, she gave vital intelligence to the Union troops during the Civil War, and she never got caught. So those are my three books.
So you think the Confederate cause was the wrong cause?
Oh, undoubtedly, yes. And so did Mary Richards, the spy in the spy in the Confederate White House.
There's a bit of a tug of war over this. I mean, the Confederacy was trying to keep the independence of the individual states. The Union was bringing everything into the power of Washington.
If I could just finish my point, thank you, all right. That's your opinion, Tony, fair enough. But, I mean, the fact is that, as Mary Richards very well understood, if the Confederacy had won the Civil War, then slavery would have continued. And as a freed black woman who felt glad that she'd been freed by her owners, she'd had an education, she wanted to fight the good fight for her fellow blacks in slavery and see that they got their freedom.
So. Well, the Confederacy obviously trusted black people.
The Confederacy trusted black people. I think they were very complacent. Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, really believed that his slaves loved him. And when the Union troops arrived at his plantation in Mississippi and said, right, you're all free now, do what you want, and 100 people, formerly enslaved people, voted with their feet and left the plantation, Jefferson Davis had a real shock. He thought they loved him and they would stay put and work for him for free forever. That did not happen.
So this interest in feminism, history, freedom issues, you put your money where your mouth is too, didn't you?
Well, I suppose you could put it that way. I felt terribly strongly about the invasion of Iraq. I mean, I spent quite a lot of time living in the Middle East, not in Iraq, but in Egypt and travelling in other countries and in Israel, Palestine. And so it was very, very close to home, I think. And when I thought, you know, Tony Blair was going to launch this or help the America to launch this invasion, I thought this completely uncalled for act of aggression was just outrageous.
So tell us about your travels in the Middle East then.
Oh, well, I've been four times to Palestine, to the occupied territories. And that included Gaza. I went with a convoy to Gaza in 2010, 2011. That was quite an adventure in itself, with hundreds of people there and a stream of vehicles, ambulances, trucks, all kinds of things, with Turks, Americans, Quakers. There was a rabbi with us. It was quite an adventure. And other times I went on fact-finding trips and human rights monitoring in a place called Nablus, which is always a kind of flashpoint. And the Israeli army had just invaded at that time, so the town was under curfew. And we were there really to, I suppose, find out what was going on and support where we could. We took some aid up a hill to some people who were being held hostage by the Israeli army. We did small things like that.
And so what about, for people who've never been, how would you describe the occupied territory?
How would I just, well, I mean, you know, there's a lot to talk about because it's a very diverse society. But, I mean, there are there are fundamentalist Muslims. There are quite secular people, westernized, very highly educated. Most Palestinians are very well educated. And the thing is that it's very oppressive for the people living there. I mean, there are random acts of violence. The settlers, they do what they want and the army backs them. They set fire to people's crops. There are checkpoints everywhere. Palestinians are not free to move about. They're constantly being stopped and monitored and harassed. Their land gets systematically seized and destroyed in the name of security. This is what the Israeli state says. Oh, we've got to destroy your olive grove because we need an army base here, or we think this is a place where terrorists can hide. And they build these settlements, which are really towns, but they fulfill the role really of Norman castles. They look down on the valleys, they look down on the villages, and they have this electronic monitoring equipment so they can see what's going on in the villages. And the settlers and the Israeli settlers and the Palestinians live very separate lives, except that I was in a place called Marda, which is under a settlement. The name of the settlement is Ariel, and Ariel would send the military down into the village from time to time. And there was a man told me this story, how he liked to go and drink coffee on his flat roof in the evenings, until the army came in one day and he went up on the roof and he was drinking his coffee, and an officer came up and said, "Come down from there. No one said you could sit on the roof. You're looking at the settlement. You're not allowed to do that." And he actually forbade him to drink coffee on his own roof. And sometimes the young men would find that they were dragged away in the night. The army would come and bang on the door and arrest the young lads, accuse them of something, whether they'd done it or not. You know, you've been throwing stones, or you've been looking at the settlement. You know, it's ongoing harassment. It's just unending. And people just have to put up with it. They don't really have any comeback.
Well, look, for a long time, the Palestinian representative was a guy called Yasser Arafat. The PLO were a very diverse group with different ethnicities, different religious beliefs, and none. Now we have Hamas, which is supposedly, anyway, an Islamic organization. It does seem as if this is trying to be framed as the Palestinians are Muslims, whereas actually what you're describing is a different ethnic mix completely.
Well, it's not an ethnic mix, but it's an ideological mix. And what the Israelis have been very clever at doing is pitting the Palestine Authority, as it now calls itself, which nominally rules over parts of the occupied territories, pitting the Palestine Authority against Hamas. And very often they're being encouraged by provocateurs to attack one another. And sometimes the Israelis encourage Hamas covertly, and sometimes they're supporting the Palestine Authority. But it keeps the turbulence, it keeps the chaos, and so that it's very hard for Palestinians to have any kind of viable authority. they're really stuck between these two factions.
So do you see it as a religious conflict?
No, actually. You know, because Palestinians, like many Arabs, are deeply religious, it takes that form, but it's actually about politics. It's about a struggle for autonomy, really. I mean, what Palestinians want is their own nationhood, their own state.
And how Jewish is the Israeli state?
Depends what you mean by Jewish. I would say that in terms of religious faith, very little. I mean, there are very devout, and of course there are the Orthodox Jews, who really reject the whole idea of a secular state, because they say we're waiting for the Messiah. They don't want a secular state. But I would say the people, the majority who participate in the secular state, I'm not sure that many Jews are that deeply religious, really.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, the way that you've got some of the Jewish Zionists who what they seem to do is they seem to say, well, actually, this is what Judaism is. This is a Jewish state. Although there are many Jews, particularly those outside Israel, mm-hmm. who say, actually, this has really got nothing to do either with the ethnic Jewish side or really the religious. I mean, thinking about people like Neturi Carter, who completely deny that Jews should be back in Israel, because mm-hmm. they say, actually, this is something we will leave to God to do, and it shouldn't be something which is forced at the barrel of a gun.
Quite right, yes, this is true. And although I'm not Jewish, I'm actually a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, which is an excellent American organization, mainly composed of younger Jews who reject the whole idea of, well, many do reject the idea of a Jewish state. And their main concern is for the rights of the Palestinians.
So we're going to be talking about Palestine Action in a minute. But first of all, your past, you were involved when it came to the Iraq War, as you were saying, in an action at Fairford, weren't you? So can you explain why Fairford, what you did and what the consequences were?
Well, Fairford was where the B-52 bombers were scheduled to take off to bomb Iraq, and they were the kind of the vanguard of the attack on Iraq.
So that's in Gloucestershire, isn't
that's
it?
That's in Gloucestershire, yes. And so these B-52 bombers, they came in, they were stationed in the airfield there. Paul Milling and I went before the planes actually arrived. We decided to try to disable the infrastructure for the planes. So we cut the brake pipes. I'll explain about this in a moment. But we cut the brake pipes on transport vehicles that were for carrying the bombs to the planes. And we went up and found some fuel tankers, and we disabled the cabs. We broke up the cabs, not the actual cab, but the dashboards inside the vehicles, and we did our very best to damage the infrastructure that enabled the planes.
So that's a bit dangerous, chopping someone's brake pipe. This is the sort of thing you see in the Avengers when you're trying to kill somebody.
Yes, well, we were well aware of that, and we put notices, we plastered these vehicles with notices saying, the brake pipes have been tampered with, please don't try to drive this vehicle, it's dangerous. So the mechanics crew would know that they were not to try to use the vehicle.
I know there were some big demonstrations up at Fairford Airfield as well, which is, it's called RAF Fairford, but really it's run by the United States, US Air Force.
That's right, it's hired out to the Americans. And when we were arrested after our action, it was actually an American aircraft, I don't know if he's an aircraftman, whatever he was, a guard, a member of the American military, came and found us in the compound, and he was actually very freaked out, and we very quickly said, look, we're non-violent, we have no weapons, you know, please don't shoot us. And he was very responsible, And as he said later in a witness statement, he had a gun, but he kept his gun pointed at the ground. And then he had to call the MOD, the Ministry of Defence police, the British police, to arrest us. And they came up and arrested us.
So how long did that take for them to arrive?
Oh, not very long, a matter of minutes.
Oh, right, so they were there anyway. But how did this fit in, this action, with the big demonstrations that were taking place? I mean, there was one I can remember attending with loads of dancing girls making the policemen's... you could see them sweating as the girls were dancing in front of them. And it was quite fascinating watching their eyes, actually. So there were some big demonstrations too, weren't there, there?
Well, yes, I mean, Paul and I took part in those demonstrations and... I suppose that was partly what encouraged us to go and do what we did in the night. We had to go at night. And one thing that surprised us, I think, was how easy it was, A, to get into the base, and B, although there was razor wire, there were coils of razor wire on the ground, but with a pair of bolt cutters, you could nibble away at this rusty razor wire and slide through gaps, and it was just... very easy to get to where we needed to get to.
So what then happened when you were arrested?
Well, then we were taken to, I don't know, some building office or something. We sat there and we waited. And then eventually local police came and took us to, I think we were taken to Stroud Police Station, or I was anyway. Paul and I were separated. We met... in the magistrate's court in the morning, and by then we had a lawyer who put in a bid for us to be released on bail, and the prosecution argued that we should not be released because obviously things were still going on and we could go and tamper with something else, and so the magistrates ordered us remanded in custody, and we spent a week in custody. I was taken to Holloway and Paul was in Gloucester Prison, which then was still a working prison. And that was it, really. We sat there for a week. Oh, that was pretty depressing because I had a television in my cell, and on the night when they were actually loading the bombs onto the planes, there was footage of that. So I saw that, the B-52 bombers being... armed to take off Iraq, and a very moving bit of footage of Robin Cook, who was the foreign secretary, who resigned on principle because he refused to condone the bombing of Iraq.
So what you'd done hadn't really worked?
Well, no, I think it didn't, actually. And when we come to talk about Palestine action, there are things I want to say about that. Because I think direct action has its uses, but I think I need to comment in more detail on that.
Okay, so what about, so were you then released after a week in custody?
Well, then, of course, the case ran for years because we wanted to argue that what we were trying to do was to prevent an act of aggression, which is a crime in international law, attacking another country without good reason is the crime of aggression.
Yeah, so you're allowed to do self-defense, but you're not allowed to start an aggressive war of aggression.
That's correct, yes. This is the law for nations. Now, the law for individuals is another matter. What we did not know, and perhaps you're a bit naive about the law, is that there was a whole discussion about whether the crime of aggression is actually written into domestic British law. And after years of debate about this, going all the way to the House of Lords, to the what became the Supreme Court, it was ruled that this does not apply in British law, which seems to me extraordinary that international law does not actually de facto rule on domestic law, but that's how it is. So we were told, after all this had gone on for years, we were told that we could argue that we honestly believed that war crimes would be committed, and that became our defence.
So you say it went on for years. Were you released during that process after a week?
Yeah, so Paul and I were on bail all that time, And we actually had two trials. By the way, there were other people who had done similar things. Phil Pritchard and Toby Aldrich were acquitted by, I think, a unanimous jury. And they had done very similar things and they were acquitted. We had a trial in Bristol in which the first time around we had a hung jury. The jury could not agree. And so a new trial was ordered. And in the second trial, we were convicted. So it seems to me that jury trials are a bit of a lottery, really. It depends who sits in judgment on you and whether your 12 peers are going to see it your way, and maybe they will, maybe they won't.
Well, it seems pretty obvious to me that war crimes were being committed in Iraq. So how come a jury found you guilty? We had the whole debacle with Catherine Gunn leaking the information at the United Nations, and there never was a UN vote that made the war legal.
Mm. Well, I quite agree. I mean, there was this dodgy dossier. There was, the vote. Well, you can argue forever about the UN vote, but the thing is,
There never was a vote at the United Nations to make the war legal.
There wasn't. I can't remember that, to be honest. But
Well, this is why Tony Blair is talked about as a war criminal, because they tried to get a vote at the UN Security Council and failed.
Oh, right. OK, well, it's such a long time ago, Tony. Don't ask me about that. I really don't recall that. But
so how come they convicted you? On what arguments did the Crown convict you? Because you're saying we're trying to stop war crimes, and apparently the jury and the judge in the second trial said, no, you're not.
I think the prosecutor, frankly, played on fear. And this is where we come back to Palestine Action, which I'm dying to speak about, because the prosecutor said, these people are non-violent, clearly. One of them is a Quaker. That was Paul Milling. They acted responsibly. I grant you that. But he said, look at what happened at Prestwick. I think at Prestwick somebody crashed a vehicle through the doors of the airport there in Glasgow. And he said, look, in a way, this action opens the door for people to commit violent acts of terrorism. And if you let these people off, by implication, you are condoning more violent actions. And I think he managed to play on the fears of the jury. That was really what it was about.
Okay, and what was the sentence?
Well, Paul Milling, who had been a magistrate in his own right in York, he got a sort of tap on the wrist. He got a conditional discharge. No previous convictions, which I suppose also helped his cause. I got a right ticking off from the judge because of all my previous convictions for criminal damage and sitting down in puddles and things. And so he gave me a real telling off. That was the worst bit of the sentence, I think. And he ordered me to wear an electronic tag for, I think, 6 months. Which wasn't so terrible, really.
No. Well, it shouldn't be too bad. So how did you find that, dragging a tag around with you everywhere?
Well, you don't drag it. It's not really heavy. It's like wearing a bracelet. You're not aware of it. And he was very nice. I said, I said I had some religious obligations 2 evenings a week for which I needed to go out. So he said, well, when are those and what time? And I told him. He said, very well, you may attend your worship twice a week, and the rest of the time you will stay at home. So I did.
So what did you feel about the action altogether afterwards?
Well, Paul and I sat and talked about it, and we said, was it all a fuss about nothing? Did we achieve anything? And,
Well, because I think the thing is, these things do have a resonance out there in society, don't they? People see this, and it gets them to start thinking about the way that Britain is used by the United States, or the way the British military might be used to break international law.
Oh, well, yes. And this is what I'm thinking again about Palestine Action. I think you have to be very clear about why you're doing it, what you're doing it. And I believe you're right. I mean, Phil Pritchard and Toby Aldrich, I think they did achieve something because, you know, they got a full acquittal. That was a victory. It was all in the press. It was all in the media. And I suppose even though we didn't win our case, we were there. We were there in front of the media. We were quite widely reported on. And, yes, so people who perhaps hadn't thought about the rights and wrongs of invading Iraq, maybe it focused the minds a bit. And I think that's the function of direct action. It's foolish to think that you can do more than that. It is a publicity stunt, really. It's what the anarchists called propaganda by deed in the Russian times when they did actually assassinate people and blow things up. And that's the second thing. I think if you're going to do direct action, you have to do it in such a way that you don't alienate the people that you're trying to inform. So I think throwing soup at a painting is just downright stupid, really. It's foolish. On the other hand, if you go to something like Elbit Systems, you know, does the electronic research and development for the Israeli warplanes, and that's in Bristol, and probably most people don't know that Elbit Systems, an Israeli company, exists in North Bristol. So you put the spotlight on that by occupying that building or demonstrating at that building. That's worth doing. That's raising consciousness. And I think you've always got to think, is this really going to upset and piss people off, or is it going to raise their awareness?
Well, it sounds like you even went one step further when you met this United States Air Force guard. You know, he's not pointing his gun at you. He's not seeing you as a threat. You're having a conversation with one of the people who's actually part of the combatants, part of the US military.
Well, he was pretty freaked at first. He was visibly scared, actually, when he first saw us. And I think, yeah, we managed to calm him down. And I don't know whether he changed his mind about the rights and wrongs of the Iraq war. I do have to say that the MOD police, when they dealt with us, they were very good. I don't know quite how to put it, but I left some stuff, some very trivial items of my property behind at the airfield, and I'd forgotten that. And when I told this to the MOD police, one of them actually said, "Oh, I'm coming into Bristol. I'll come by your house and I'll drop off your things." You know, they were very decent. I think that's the word. They're very decent with us. And after the trial, when we lost our case, the man with the box, as they called him, the man who had the bits of evidence, the bolt cutters and the things that we'd used, he actually came over and shook us by the hand.
Amazing.
It was almost a tennis match, you know.
Because I think sometimes the military themselves are more aware than the public about the consequences of breaking international law. And I can remember it was the Royal British Legion, I think about 15, 20 years ago, for a while had on their newspaper and on their website that we believe that war is unnecessary, that we will abolish war.
Oh, right. Well, that's interesting. Yes, I am very well aware that, the military are often much more reluctant to go to war than the politicians are, because they do understand what it means. And yeah.
So anyway, on to Palestine Action, which you've been itching to talk about. This group, since particularly in the last 18 months, since the genocide began against the people in Gaza, the Palestine Action have been very active, haven't they?
They have indeed, yes. And I think some of their actions have been very good. And I don't know, Yvette Cooper as Home Secretary, she says that they resort to violence. I only read about them, but I've never seen or heard any evidence that they're violent. I don't know whether they're accountable. I think, for me, there's a very important principle, which when I work with Trident Plowshares, which is an anti-nuclear movement, direct action, they had a set of guidelines, which are you're accountable for what you do, you're open in what you do. So if you're not arrested, then you have to go and report yourself. You have to say, look, we've done this. And this is to avoid the accusation of terrorism or secrecy or underhand dealing. So everybody's on the same level playing field. And then you're willing to go to court and explain what you've done, which is really what the thing is about. You need to make the case that you have, you've done this for such and such a reason, you know, for the horrors that are being committed in Gaza. You have to be able to talk about that. And then you need to be nonviolent. So it's nonviolence, accountable, responsible, and, you know, overall open.
So how can you smash up an arms factory or a Hawk jet nonviolently?
Well, it's swords into plowshares. You're disarming a weapon. But actually, as far as I can see, the last thing that Palestine Action did was spray paint on a jet. Well, that's a prank. I mean, that's not a sabotage even, that's a prank. And
so it's not going to stop the plane flying, is it?
Well, of course not. But I mean, it won't look pretty, but that's not the point, is it? And what's happening in Gaza is certainly not pretty. But to come back to the point, I think, you know, even in law, forget about ethics, the legality of it. You know, if you look at how the law judges different offences, there's shoplifting, and then there's burglary while carrying a weapon. And you don't judge these two things in the same light. You know, there's a distinction made in levels of criminality, if you will. So there's criminal damage, which is throwing paint on a plane, and there's terrorism, which is blowing a lot of people up in a theatre or a marketplace. That's terrorism. And if you don't make these distinctions, well, where are we, you know?
So you mentioned Trident Plowshares. Mm. I'm assuming that's some sort of religious group. I mean, I'm thinking about Swords into Plowshares. You've just said that yourself.
Yeah, well, Trident Plowshares is a secular movement, but it has a lot of Quakers in it. And, yeah, so, yes, no, it's a secular movement. But, yes, they take this analogy of beating swords into plowshares as a sort of, you know, a hallmark of what they do.
And historically, what have Trident Plowshares been up to?
Well, a lot of, well, I've done some of this, cutting through fences at Aldermaston. That's a sort of low-level thing.
So this is a nuclear research base?
Well, it's actually where they make the warheads at Aldermaston. Right. It's a weapons factory. And then at Faslane, where the submarines are kept, you have people swimming to submarines. And I think two women did actually get on a submarine and do a bit of, you know, damage.
You mean get into it?
Well,
or onto it?
Onto it. Okay. Onto it. Yeah, they got onto it and damaged, I think, something on the conning tower or, yeah. And there were two young Swedes. Now, this is interesting, you see. I think sometimes these actions actually have a different kind of function. At Devonport, where they also have nuclear submarines come in for servicing, two young Swedes got onto one of these submarines in the middle of the night, very easily, without any trouble, and they, because they were accountable, they actually had to sound the alarm. They had to call a security guard because there was nobody there to catch them. He said, oh, but we are accountable, what shall we do? And they found an alarm bell or something and they pressed it. And a security guard came running. And then they were arrested. And it was all in the local paper the following day. And the big question was, how did these people manage to get onto this submarine? Where was the security? So you're actually doing a public service by drawing attention to the lack of security. I mean, it's, you know, it's ironic, but there it is. It's the, in a way, it's opposite of terrorism. It's safeguarding.
Yeah, it's not terrorism, that's for sure. But anyway, look, I know the current Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, has been involved in some of these human rights cases in the past before he was Director of Public Prosecutions and then went on to be Prime Minister. Was he involved in your case at Fairford at all?
Well, he was indeed. When it got to the House of Lords, what's now the Supreme Court, he was one of those who was arguing about the use of the crime of aggression in the court. So he was very much involved. And before that, he was Mr. Human Rights. I mean, he was with Amnesty cases, with Liberty, and In fact, it was he who got us the funding from Liberty for our case, you know. So I don't know what happened to that man. I think when he became director of public prosecutions, something must have clicked in his brain, or perhaps he just wanted to rise in the political establishment. I mean, I wonder about Yvette Cooper. You know, her argument that what Palestine Action do is terrorism is just sheer stupidity in my mind. It's just illogical. But I wonder if she also has an agenda that she thinks this is going to benefit her political career. I don't know.
Yeah, Starmer should know human rights law, and yet he seems to be leading the country into breaking it.
Well, he does, doesn't he? And, you know, I think on this civil liberties issue of you know, calling direct action terrorism, I just think it's very muddled thinking, isn't it? You know, criminal damage and terrorism, they are different. You know, you're going to kill a lot of people, that's one thing. You're going to throw some paint at an aeroplane, that's another. And if you conflate them, then you lose all sense of values, of relative values, don't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems to be undermining democracy in Britain, because we're seeing, I mean, even locally, I mean, we're in Stroud, locally in Nailsworth, they have, it's a tiny little town, I would say even possibly a village, Nailsworth, really. It's they have a regular peace vigil there for Palestine, and yet the government is on the opposite side. It's the opposite side of the fence, supporting. Supporting the, you know, so the people are quite clearly prepared to give up their time, come out on the streets to support human rights for the Palestinians and to stop the genocide, yet the government is saying the opposite. So what does that tell us about democracy?
Well, yes, there's a complete split, isn't there, between the... Well, certainly with the cabinet. I mean, I think a lot of MPs are quite supportive of ending the genocide, ending the... I mean, the real scandal to me is the arms shipments coming from Britain to help the Israelis' onslaught on Gaza. I mean, that is, you know... total complicity in criminality in a way that I cannot understand. You know, it's as if you were helping the Nazis in the Second World War to murder Jews. I mean, it's just unconscionable. And actually, we have a very good MP here, Simon Ofer. He's very outspoken on behalf of the Palestinians.
What about the military? Surely there are military solutions to this. The British military could possibly send in commandos to seize Israeli nuclear weapons. The British military could could drop air supplies into the Gaza Strip to keep Palestinians alive. I mean, this is looking like it needs to be a military solution to this in Gaza. 18 months of genocide and starvation.
Well, yes, I'm not sure about a military intervention, because I think those things usually end badly. But at one point, there were airdrops, weren't there, of aid into Gaza. I think maybe the Jordanians were doing it.
Well, the British did a bit as well.
The British did a bit of token airdropping, yeah. But, yes, I just don't know. I think
isn't this what the United Nations are for, Margaret?
I think the first thing is that the Americans, but of course with Donald Trump, it's not never going to happen. And Biden was an out-and-out Zionist. But you know, it would take would be a complete embargo on arms. So, right, we're not giving you any aid, any kind of aid, any military aid, any domestic aid. You're just not getting it. And I think, you know, the Israelis would come to heel overnight. The thing is, you know, particularly Britain and America, well, let's begin with America, and Britain gets dragged along. But I think really there's this interest in keeping the military-industrial complex fed. And if you've read Jeff Halper's books, he's very, very clued up, I would say, on the connection of research and development in Israel and the manufacture of weapons in Western countries that then get shipped to Israel.
So what you're saying is the Western military-industrial complex is actually dependent on Israeli research and development?
Well, there's an interdependence. And shockingly, for years now, Gaza has been used as a kind of testing ground for new electronic equipment, new kinds of bombs, and that's part of the connection, that they're using Palestinians as kind of experimental guinea pigs, which is horrible.
Okay, so with the United Nations, originally it was set up to intervene in situations like this to stop wars of aggression. We're talking particularly about Gaza, the Israeli troops in there, killing, shooting, not just fighters, but obviously lots of civilians too. In Yugoslavia, for example, there was a UN-sanctioned intervention there. Why not in Gaza? To have some sort of peacekeeping force in there to keep the Israeli army away from Palestinian civilians?
Well, you're certainly making a case, Tony, but I think the political will is simply not there.
No, you're probably right. Back to Palestine Action, what would you advise people who are activists, non-violent direct activists? You've already said, suggested anyway, that people should be accountable to stand up in public, to take off face masks and things like that, to actually go through the court process. But many, of course, of these Palestine activists want to go in the middle of the night, maybe break up some equipment used to make drones, and then run off and hopefully not get arrested.
Yeah, well, I think that's misguided. I mean, it may be very brave, but I think it's misguided because, for one thing, you're losing the whole opportunity, really, to make your case in a way that wins you sympathy. It makes you look shady and dodgy and, you know, it's easy for someone like Yvette Cooper to stereotype you as a terrorist because people don't really know what you're about. People have to know what you're about, know that you have principles, know that you're prepared to defend your principles, know that you're non-violent. All these things really matter. And you don't, just stop oil, but you don't throw soup at paintings. You know, you go for something that really symbolizes what it is that you, what you oppose. So, you know, a jet plane, you know, an arms factory, these are legitimate as targets and places where you can make your point.
Well, look, Palestine Action will say what's been going on is appalling because people who have done actions and been arrested, they're still awaiting trial. Sometimes for a year and a half, they're sitting in prison waiting for a trial. So this is a way, obviously, of, even though they're not of a danger to the public, supposedly, the courts are saying, well, we think you might do it again. The trial's going to take a very long time. I'm very sorry. So they're all, basically, they've, even before the trial, they have been sentenced to a long jail terms.
Well, sure. I mean, I absolutely agree that the way that the state is dealing with these people is completely wrong. On the other hand, I mean, I suppose Paul and I, we were fortunate that the state was much more lenient with us. And, of course, the fact that the thing dragged on and on, it became a very ancient case by the time. But we were on bail for years, and that was in itself quite stressful. And we were prepared to go to prison for 2 years, if that's what it took. In the States, when somebody goes and, you know, does a tiny bit, puts a dent in a cone of a missile or something like that on an airbase, they can be sentenced to 10, 20 years. I mean, you know, the British state is actually relatively lenient. I mean, I don't think it's fun to be on remand for 2 years. But if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. And you have to know what you're getting into and be prepared to face the consequences.
Yes, well, the idea, it seems, is to make it absolutely clear to people that if you do this, whether you're guilty or not guilty, you're still going to be doing a long stretch in prison.
Yeah, but it doesn't work, does it? Because, you know, if people are that concerned, they're that principled, you know, if they're that upset at which they rightly should be about what's happening in Gaza, then they will do that. I mean, you think about people in the Second World War who were so horrified by what's being done to the Jews that they joined resistance. You know, you can't suppress people's principled actions simply by locking them up. You can't.
So obviously the law has been changed, hasn't it? So it sounds to me as if Britain is becoming more like America in this too. I mean, actually, of course, the Supreme Court was an import from the United States.
I think that's true, yes. I think American political and public culture is having a baneful influence on Britain. I do think that's the case, yes.
The other thing is, of course, this is likely, and I'm sure the state is aware of this, to drive those non-violent activists underground.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but that might be true. And I think if that happens, it's regrettable because, you know, you're going to lose the point of direct action. For me, the point of direct action is that you can make a point. You know, you can show people something. And if you're just smashing things in the dark and disappearing, then you're really losing public sympathy. You're losing the point of what you're doing, really.
So anyway, what would you say to people who are thinking they want to support Palestine? And obviously people will be of all sorts of different dimensions here. Some will just maybe want to donate a bit of money, some maybe to go out on a peace vigil. There are lots of different things you can do. Non-violent direct action is not the only one, is it?
No, absolutely not. And I think a whole range of actions is important. The demonstrations that go on, you know, every week after week in London, then you've got the local vigils. But I think the most useful thing, actually, that anyone can do right now is the boycott, divestment and sanctions, which is now really beginning to catch on. I remember this happening with South Africa with the anti-apartheid boycotts. And it began with boycotting consumer goods, oranges, and we all stopped eating Outspan oranges. And then it goes to banks. You pull your bank account out of Barclays. Ironically, again, it's Barclays that we have to boycott about Israel. Then it's divesting, and this is where it really gets important. Universities have started now from divesting any investments they've got in Israel. They're taking them out. Churches are doing that. Bristol Council, I believe, has divested. Several councils around Britain have now pulled their investments out. The same thing is happening in America. The Methodists, the Quakers, divesting. And I think as that catches on and catches on, you know, it will hit the Israeli economy. And the only difference, I think, is that in South Africa, the supporters of apartheid were pragmatic. And it got to a point where they said, well, this is hurting us economically. And this apartheid thing just isn't working. We'll ditch it. I don't know with the Israelis whether they've got a sort of almost a Masada complex where they would go to the wall rather than give up. But I don't, you know, give justice to the Palestinians. I don't know. I think, you know, very often the economic argument bites hardest. And if you can really make a divestment campaign work, it's a very powerful tool, I think.
Yeah. Well, some of the Israeli ministers have been saying, we don't care what the world thinks anymore. We're prepared to go right to the end. And that could mean Armageddon.
Well, it's not what the world thinks, it's what the world does. And it's one thing to make a speech in the Knesset, but you wait till it hits your bank account and then you might think differently.
How far do you think the Israelis will push this?
How far will they push what? Gaza?
Well, the greater Israel, the expansion of the Israeli state and ethnic cleansing and genocide.
Oh, well, clearly there are people who would like to take over Lebanon, possibly take over Jordan. You know, there are...
Syria,
yeah, there are expansionists in Israel who really would like to take over neighbouring Arab countries. How much the will for that among the general public is, I have no idea. But,
well, recent surveys say, anything up to complete extermination of Palestinians, I mean, that is just under 50% of the Israeli population, but certainly a good 75-80% believe that the land is theirs and they just want everybody off.
Oh, for sure, yes, if they could drive all the Palestinians somewhere else, but, you know, it doesn't work. I mean, you... You can't just get rid of people by shooing them away. They're not
chickens. They have been since World War II. The Israeli settlers have been pushing people out constantly since for the last 80 years.
They have, but there's nowhere for them to go now. I mean, what's horrible about Gaza is those people are trapped. If they wanted to leave, they can't because the Egyptians won't let them in. I mean, and I understand the Egyptian point. It's a recipe for a civil war. If you let 2 million Palestinians into Egypt, you're going to have a civil war. So the Egyptians keep their border closed. The Israelis would love to drive them all into Egypt, but that's not going to happen. Where can they go? Where can they go?
The latest is the last few weeks, the Israelis have been killing between 50 and 100 Palestinians every day who are trying to get food. So the idea is the food is over here, come and get it, and then between 50 and 100 Palestinians every day are being shot dead.
Well, I've seen that. Yes, that's awful. But, I mean, there are 2 million of them, you know.
There's a lot to get through, you mean?
That's a horrible way to put it, but yes.
So at the end of the day, this is looking a little bit like Nazi Germany to some people, seeing the way that the Nazis just said, we need more Lebensraum. They kept invading small areas. They invaded Czechoslovakia. They invaded the Sudetenland. Eventually, when it came to Poland, the British said, right, that's enough. And so would you agree with some of the comparisons between the expansionism of Nazi Germany, the racism, the ethnic cleansing of the Jews by the Nazis and communists and gypsies, etc., with the Israeli racist attitudes and expansionist attitude?
Well, what's happening in Gaza looks horribly like a concentration camp, I grant you. But I do think every situation is different. And I'm not sure if I'd want to make a direct analogy, because, as I say, I think situations are different. And my brother-in-law's parents were actually, they had to flee from Czechoslovakia because the Nazis, they're Jewish, and the Nazis would have murdered them. Well, murdered, in fact, my brother-in-law's relatives, I think, who couldn't get out. But, I don't know whether I'd make that comparison directly. I think there are differences.
Okay, so what about if people are interested in reading some of your books, following your work? What's out there, and what can people get hold of, Margaret?
Right, well, none of them deal with Palestine, but the first one is Æthelflæd, which is the Anglo-Saxon princess who built kingdoms, founded kingdoms, Warwick, not kingdoms, towns. She wasn't that grandiose. Towns, Warwick, Stafford, Shrewsbury, Tamworth, others. She actually built those by founding settlements, which then grew into towns. That was one I enjoyed reading because writing. I travelled around and took photos, and that was very interesting to me. Then there's the Victorian Egyptologist, Amelia Edwards. That's The Adventurous Life of Amelia B. Edwards. She was also a novelist, and she travelled widely, including going on a mule up through the Dolomites, and she went up the Nile on a barge, and that's how she fell in love with ancient Egypt. And then the third one, which is the one very dear to my heart, is this She Spied for Freedom, about Mary Richards, the black spy in the Confederate White House.
Do you do any social media?
I tinker with it. I don't really like it, if I'm honest, but I'm on Facebook and LinkedIn.
Okay, Monica Margaret Jones, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.